come conuloque manusiendram, pituratma krita puman, pratikartum shamoyasya, prashadat vindate param, shi pururuvacha, konuloke manusyendra, pituratma krita puman, pratikartum shamoyasya, prasadat vindate param. Please chant. Shri Pururuvacha Konuloke manusyendra Pituratma krita puman Pratikartum shamoyasya Prasadat vindate param. Okay, so I'm going to read the translation of text 41 and 42 and then come to the word for word for 43. So the translation for text 41. O Maharaj Parikshit, Yayati similarly requested his sons Turvasu, Druyu, and Anu to exchange their youth for his old age. But because they were unaware of religious principles, they thought that their flickering youth was eternal, and therefore they refused to carry out their father's order. Text 42. King Yayati then requested Puru, who was younger than these three brothers, but more qualified. My dear son, do not be disobedient like your elder brothers, for that is not your duty. And then text 43. We'll do the word for word prior to the translation. Shri Pururuvacha. Puru said, Ka, what, to, indeed, loke, in this world, Manusya Indra, O your majesty, best of human beings, Pitu, the father, Arma Krita, who has given this body, Puman, a person, Pratikartum, to repay. Shamaham is able, Yasya, of whom, Prasadat, by that mercy, by this mercy, sorry, Vindate, one enjoys, Param, superior life. So the translation for text 43, Puru replied, O your majesty, who in this world can repay his debt to his father? By the mercy of one's father, one gets the human form of life, which can enable one to become an associate of the Supreme Lord. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The father gives the seed of the body, and this seed gradually grows and develops until one ultimately attains the developed human body, with consciousness higher than that of the animals. In the human body, one can be elevated to the higher planets, and furthermore, if one cultivates Krishna consciousness, one can return home back to Godhead. This important human body is obtained by the grace of the Father, and therefore everyone is indebted to his Father. Of course, in other lives, one also gets a father and mother. Even cats and dogs have fathers and mothers. But in the human form of life, the father and mother can award their son the greatest benediction by teaching him to become a devotee. When one becomes a devotee, he achieves the greatest benediction because he completely averts the repetition of birth and death. Therefore, the father who trains his child in Krishna consciousness is the most benevolent father in this world. It is said, Janame, Janame, Sabe, Pitatmata Paya, Krishna Guru Nahi, Mule, Mile, Buja Hari, E. Everyone gets a father and mother, but if one gets the benediction of Krishna and Guru, he can conquer material nature and return home back to Godhead. Om Agyana Timurandasya Gananjana Chalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Rama Padaswami Iti Namine. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Iti Namine. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschacya Deshatarine. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Vancha Kalpa Trubhyas Chakripa Sindhubhya Vacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnebhyo Namo Namaha. This particular verse, the focus that we have today on text 43, we have King Yayati's son responding to his father's request, and he's expressing the very high esteem in which he views his father. And that high esteem that he holds his father in is due to the fact that he feels indebted to his father. And the reason for this indebtedness that he feels is that he views his father as having bestowed kindness upon him just by virtue of the fact that through his father he was able to receive the particular body that he's occupying. And the reason this he feels indebted for the particular body is that the human body that he's residing in allows him to use that body so that ultimately he can become an associate of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Krishna. So this is Puru, Prince Puru's thinking. And of course the request his father had made of him was most unusual, that he be willing to take on the decrepit invalidity of his father in terms of the body, and in exchange give his father his youthful body. So it's very unusual, this particular response, because he's evaluating his view of his father, and he's evaluating this question of exchanging his youth. So now in the purport, Srila Prabhupada is pointing out that what is provided by the father is a seed. And that seed is what permits an embryo to grow and to develop. So, you know, if one looks on the physiological level, the significance of that little seed provided by the father, you know, it amounts to some microscopic little ball that is, you know, just a bunch of rapidly multiplying cells, and that's what an embryo is called. And but just within 6 weeks, there's a tiny beating heart that's present just by that seed that's been provided. And and then a little bit further along, a little nose, a little mouth, little ears, all begin to develop just by the seed. And and ultimately, some intestines develop, the brain develops. And and this is all in the size of a lentil, literally. That is actually how big all of this is as this development is going on. So extremely small. And this is just by virtue of that act of the Father that a human life is shaping itself. So, and it's in just something like 3 months, these teeny microscopic almost little limbs can actually bend. And even something so teeny as a nail starts to form. So it's like, you know, very extraordinary what is contained in that seed that's given by the Father. And, you know, in a similar way, I mean, this is highly complex, the development of a human body. in the plant kingdom, you know, often one has the example of the seed from a tree. So, you know, one observes a huge pine tree, perhaps, and, you know, the cones fall down in these little seeds, and in that tiny little seed will be the ingredient for another huge pine tree. So, and sometimes, you know, the examples used of a banyan tree, we're not so familiar with banyan trees here, but this is very prominent in the Vedic literature. So, when we were on pilgrimage recently, going through the various places of pastimes of Lord Ramachandra, we came to one spot that it was the kingdom of a king called Guya, and there's just a little section of the Ganges visible there. So at that particular point was where Lord Ramachandra crossed the Ganges in order to begin his 12 years of isolation in the forest. And as we were entering this road leading to the spot on the Ganges, everybody was very amazed because there was a banyan tree, and part of the banyan tree was a neem tree. And so anyway, I was just remembering that because of this seed containing all the intelligence that requires a huge tree to grow. And actually, in the case of a banyan tree, that particular seed germinates in a host tree. So that sort of very slender neem tree that was there was the spot for germination of this seed of a huge banyan tree. So there was this neem tree encased by a banyan tree, very unusual. So we don't see these things here, but in Ayodhya this was the case. So now Srila Prabhupada, he generalizes and says that everybody's body is actually a sample universe. So the material elements that are present in the universe are also present within a particular body. So, for example, in a human body, you know, if one touches it, there's warmth. So this indicates that fire is present. So that's one of the elements in the material universe. And so on too, you know, one may not perceive the water, but then, you know, should it be a hot day or should one actually run? Then, you know, one sees water oozing, so one understands there's water, that it's a material element that's part of the composition of the particular human body. So on a small scale, the human body has all the elements that are present within the universe. You know, fire, air, ether, space. Now, this is not only the case in a human body, which I was attempting to describe a little bit the development of, but also in the case of an insect body or a plant body, the same thing. The material elements, all of them are present within whichever body is there in the material universe. So what's present externally in the material universe is also on smaller scale present within a particular body. And now, the original King Puru, or Prince Puru, is particularly looking at this, the value of the human body, and he's acknowledging, you know, something of what I've described, the extraordinary contribution from the father that allowed him to have the particular body that he has. But then if one actually looks at the broader picture, and Prince Puru does, you know, he moves from that point of the conception to much further along where one's actually in the spiritual world. So, you know, if one were to also look at the concept of father, there's also the original father of every living entity, irrespective of the body form, and that's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And Krishna himself says this. He says, and this is from Bhagavad Gita in the 4th chapter, in the 5th verse, he says, "It should be understood that all species of life, O son of Kunti, are made possible by birth in this material nature, and that I am the seed-giving father." So that those elements contained in the seed that allow for the particular body to come are actually Krishna. He's actually providing all of that. So the father's the instrument in some way for that seed to then take on the embryonic form and mature and come to form a perfect human body. But in actual fact, Krishna is the provider of all those elements contained within the seed. And I'm going to read the Sanskrit. It's a fantastic verse. Sarva janishu kunteya murtaya sambhavantiya tasham brahma mahad yonir aham bija pradapita. So the fact that a living entity appears is due to this combination of material nature and spiritual nature. So one cannot separate it out. So there's that which consists of matter, these elements, these material elements that occupy space. So it may be initially, you know, the size of a lentil, all these material elements. It may then finally, just prior to actually birth taking place, maybe the size of a small watermelon. But and then you know, in through gradual growth, one may, you know, occupy 6 feet of space, or height wise maybe a little bit less. But so there's that consists of matter and that occupies space and is given birth to. And there's also that something that's the essence of the particular individual. So one has to make that distinction between the two. One can say that the physical body is changing at every moment because of the actions and the reactions of the different cells. So, you know, the initially at conception, you know, those cells are multiplying, and, you know, some just a little circular lump, you know, starts to take the shape of a human body. And if one is in an adult human body, there's still this action and reaction of cells going on. I mean, the scientific view is that every 7 years, all the cells in the body are completely different. So, you know, there's constant turnover, change happening. And this change leads, you know, over time one sees to aging because that action and reaction slows down. And so then, you know, the skin, instead of being taut, you know, starts to sag, or the hair, instead of being, you know, bright and shiny, starts to look dry and grayed. So, but it's an indication that those not visible to the naked eye, but there's those actions and reactions of the cells going on constantly. And so that there's that growth, and then there's a slowdown of the whole internal process of the cell action and reaction. And but the essence, the spirit soul within, is existing permanently, and there isn't any change. And so one can say that the nature of the body is ever-changing, while the soul, by nature, is eternal. This is because the composition of the soul is quite different. It's of a spiritual nature, so different ingredients. The ingredients are bliss, eternity, and knowledge. So one, such refined substance, extremely refined substance. I mean, if one thinks how fine a particular thought is, you know, it's not that, you know, it has weight, or that, you know, it's occupies space. It's very fine. So the soul, in a similar way, if one thinks of, you know, many thoughts that are understood, so knowledge and the eternity of it, you know, it can't be cut or dried or withered in any way. So it's eternally there, permanently existing. So there's a verse in the Bhagavatam that explains this quite nicely. And this is what this verse says. In this world, we can see that pots, dolls, and other products of the earth appear, break, and then disappear, mixing with the earth. Similarly, the bodies of all conditioned living entities are annihilated. But the living entity, like the earth itself, is unchanging and never annihilated. And that verse says, Na hanya te hanya mane sharire. So that's from the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the sixth verse. Just to, you know, kind of graphically illustrate the experience one has of objects. I guess particularly ones that are made of organic ingredients, because I don't think plastic comes into this picture, in this description of the Bhagavatam, but clay pots, I presume, and clay dolls, I presume. You know, they're made of earth and they go back to the earth because they break. So, I mean, unfortunately, we know that plastic, there's something like it doesn't break down, and I think they have some figure for it. And it comes to like something like 1,000 years, they say. I do not know, but anyway. So anyway, even if it is 1,000 years for something that's man-made and such a disgusting substance, it's still is different from the unchanging spirit soul of made of those very refined ingredients that can't be annihilated at all. You know, it doesn't return to the earth. It's you know, permanently existing and can't be affected by material elements in any way. So so this initial seed that's given by the father, and that has the embryo gradually growing from that blueberry size or lentil size to the size of a mini melon, means it grows to like about 20 inches. It's such that there's a developed human body that comes to be there with the required intelligence. And this is something that, you know, Srila Prabhupada talks so much in many of his lectures. He always goes back to this, the value of the human body. So our society is influenced a great deal by Darwinian thinking and his theories. And according to Darwin, this is his thinking. So he says that there isn't a fundamental difference between man and higher mammals. Because he, as he views it, he thinks that mental faculties like intelligence are just a matter of degree, not of kind. So he says that he believes that there are common cognitive traits, such as curiosity. So he's talking about man and higher mammals, such as curiosity or wonder, long-term memory, the ability to imitate others, to pay attention, and he even puts to reason. So I recall when I was studying psychology, unfortunately in the university where I was, there was indeed a lab that had some primates and a particular psychologist that was conducting his experiments. And I say unfortunately because I think those poor animals aren't necessarily protected by some sort of ethics. So. Anyway, I do recall that some of the experiments of that time were a particular primate could recognize words. So, you know, words were put there and the primate could comprehend even a somewhat abstract concept like love. So, which was very interesting. So just very simple words, but the particular primate, I don't know if it was a chimpanzee, I presume a chimpanzee, could actually come to recognize words and understand what the word, the meaning of the word. So that means some abstract thought was possible. And this is what I think Darwin is pointing to. But there is, of course, a distinct difference between a human and an animal, particularly in terms of intelligence, and because the ability of humans to use language obviously is, you know, far superior, and the ability to think abstractly is clearly far superior, and most of all, there's self-awareness, which is not so visible. I guess even in those primates that, you know, have some ability to recognize language or comprehend language. So Srila Prabhupada puts it this way, consciousness is higher in the human than in animals. So in the same way that the seed of the father is what permits development of the embryo, the subtle form of creation takes a similar course. So I'm going to describe that a little because I had alluded to the fact that, you know, the body, you know, represents like the material elements that are also present in the external universe. So in a similar way that the embryo develops, there's also a subtle form of creation that goes on in the universe. So this is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam in the third canto. So it's described this way that the subtle form of creation, so just by thought, so the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu, it actually takes shape by something piercing through his abdomen, and that which pierces through his abdomen is actually the sum total form. And this is so, it's such an advanced abstract concept, but you know, one has to somehow try and comprehend it, is the total form of all the fruitive activities of the living entities. That actually is what pierces through his abdomen. This is described in the third canto in the eighth chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam. So it means those activities that all the living entities have performed where they haven't actually done those activities in relation to Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna. So they're called fruitive activities, meaning they're doing it for their own pleasure or their own gratification. So Those fruitive activities, so it's such a subtle concept, those fruitive activities that somehow take shape in the form of a bud of a lotus that pierces through the abdomen of Lord Vishnu. And this is the description. Into that universal lotus flower, Lord Vishnu personally enters as the super soul. And when it is thus impregnated with all the modes of material nature, the personality of Vedic wisdom, whom we call the self, was generated. So it's a very difficult concept, but this is how it's described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a similar sort of taking birth kind of thing that takes place, but it's... all the fruitive activities of the living entities that give shape to some sort of shape to what emerges as material nature. And on this gigantic form of the Lord in the material world is the form from which this lotus flower is generated. So this comprises that description of the Lord as the seed-giving father. Because as Garbhadakshay Vishnu, he enters as the sum total of all the fruitive activities of the living entities. Very difficult to comprehend, but this is the description in the, given in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now, Srila Prabhupada, he writes that... there's an instruction that Lord Krishna gives right in the beginning... Because humans generally emerge in a very bewildered condition. So they're under the influence of the mode of ignorance because they've been performing fruitive activities, meaning activities that are not connected to Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna. So Srila Prabhupada writes that what's necessary is the removal of that ignorance. And the removal of that ignorance is to re-establish that eternal relationship between the worshipper and the worshippable. So then there's the consequent understanding that comes once one begins to re-establish that relationship, that there's a difference between the living entity who's a relatively small part of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself. So there's a sequence that has to take place. And I'm going into this a little bit in detail because of Prince Puru's placing so much emphasis on the value of a human body. So there's... a part in where Srila Jiva Goswami looks at this in Tattva Sandarbha, text 57, where he states that because intelligence has been darkened by ignorance for many lifetimes, there's special help that's needed to find one's way out of bewilderment. So the Bhagavatam teaches two gradual ways of understanding the Supreme Lord. This is Srila Jiva Goswami. So the first thing he gives to help one is contemplation of one's own spiritual nature. And secondly, it's study of the universal creation. So this is Srila Jiva Goswami, the particular ways that he's recommending that one, even with taking that human body, breaks out of that ignorance because of all the fruitive activities from many lifetimes. So this is how he's recommending it, contemplating one's spiritual nature and studying the universal creation. So this contemplation is interesting, which is that self-awareness that's particularly connected to a human being that one doesn't find in animals. It means that the spirit soul can find his own self through reflection. So I find this very extraordinary, Srila Jiva Goswami writing about this, because you know, I've spent so many years in my Krishna conscious life teaching children in particular, And I was taught a methodology because I studied teaching philosophy to children that particularly places emphasis on self-reflection. So, you know, through discussion and utilizing various tools, what's supposed to happen is that there's a lot of reflection that will go on subsequent to the class. So, and this is how the spirit soul is able to actually find his own self through that kind of reflection. So there's a spiritual microcosm, a small reflected image of God's perfection. This is how Srila Jiva Goswami puts it. So in the universal creation, one can find a macrocosm, and in that universal creation, one can discern the Lord's divine potency and mercy. So one has to do both things. This is Srila Jiva Goswami talking, so I've tried to touch on it a little bit in accord with his instruction. Now, Puru's indebtedness for the seed given by his father that placed him as the Jiva, that imperishable soul in a human body, is related to his seeing that he has the possibility of actually existing as a spirit soul in a spiritual atmosphere that's none different from that spirit soul, meaning that he doesn't have the obstruction of material nature and all the workings that go along with the body and material nature and the dissolution of the body at some point. So, and in that spiritual realm, it's the Lord is enjoying with his pure devotees so many kinds of loving reciprocations. So it's an atmosphere that's saturated with bliss, transcendental bliss. So there's a nice commentary by Gopi Pranadana, also coming from Tattva Sandarbha, where he comments that if one makes a comparison with the material creation, one can actually see that the material creation, the affairs over here, are generally very mean and very unpleasant. I mean, there's it just takes a little bit of ego to emerge and there's a complete breakdown immediately. The interactions become quite mean and quite unpleasant. I have this interesting kind of experimental chamber where I'm observing this recently because I'm having to deal with some repairs for a small apartment that I'm going to be residing in. And so there's neighbors to deal with. So I haven't lived in a building that has, you know, neighbors everywhere. I've been in homes that are, you know, on big land. So I've not had to worry about this so much. But just one little item out of place. Like the person who was doing construction placed some debris in one of those disposal containers. Within 2 seconds, somebody has taken a photograph of it. I'm getting an extremely mean letter arriving from the board that, you know, this is not permissible. So generally, dealings are mean and unpleasant. I mean, there's a there's other ways of going about things if one is a thoughtful person and is certainly if one is practicing elevating one's consciousness, one's actually going to be very cautious and first always try and understand the position of somebody else rather than immediately going into attack. But the general way is the attack mode is the regular way of functioning, unfortunately. So Srila Jiva Goswami's comment that the affairs over here are generally mean and unpleasant. So one can see Prince Puru has some insight where he's looking forward to that possibility of being able to enter into the spiritual realm to have these kind of loving reciprocal relationships where, you know, the emphasis is on serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead, so therefore one is always on one's very best behavior. So Devaki, and I'm jumping now, she gives an explanation of how an associate of the Supreme Lord is actually looking at things once he's understood that how material nature is conquered. So this is how she puts it. No one in this material world has become free from the four principles, birth, death, old age, and disease, even by fleeing to various planets. But now that you have appeared, my Lord, death is fleeing in fear of you, and the living entities have obtained shelter at your lotus feet. They are sleeping in full mental peace. So this is very significant because devotees who've taken shelter of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord can sleep peacefully. They can function peacefully. Because there's the assurance that after they're giving up this present body, they don't have to return to this place of strife and impermanence. And this Krishna reinforces this, janma karma chame divyam evam yoveti tatvataha tyaktva deham punar janma naitimam eti so arjunam. So one who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving this body, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode. So being able to utilize the intelligence of the human body can allow one to understand the truth of the Lord's appearance, and so one's freed from material nature, and one can return to the kingdom of God, which is Puru's aim. Prince Puru's aim. So the intelligence that comes with the human body can be used to understand the Lord's activities and his body, and in this way we can attain his abode. And this is because one starts to inhabit that realm by becoming absorbed and carefully reflecting and carefully understanding the nature of his activities and his form. So the point is to understand with complete conviction. So this is the significant part. And, you know, because I spend years and years and years working with children, and I'm spending a lot of time understanding the Lord's pastimes, because we study Krishna book a great deal. I'm actually seeing that, you know, when I have students for many years, there's a definite conviction that comes there. There's a certainty that this is a reality that is there. And it's always very heartening, this. And this is the recommendation that in order to actually be able to truly not have to go through this process of taking birth again, there's that necessity to have complete conviction in the Lord's activities and his pastimes. And Prince Puru is able to, on the basis of this, he's able to consider taking on prematurely old age. I mean, it's quite extraordinary, because he's aware that taking shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord gives mental peace. And there's actual freedom from old age and disease and death. So he's looking up ahead. It's not of concern to him, the present condition. because he knows that through becoming an associate of the Lord, these particular factors connected to material nature, the aging and the disease and the death, once it passes that, it's no longer there. So he's functioning already as the eternal soul. So I found that very extraordinary when I was just contemplating his state of mind and trying to examine this question. So these are some thoughts on this verse. If there's anything that can expand our discussion, I would be most grateful.
Hare Krishna. Thank you for class. That's nice, a lot of nice points. Meditating on the point you were speaking about the embryo becoming human body. That was nice reflection. Just even just materially, it's pretty astonishing, the human form of life and how everything comes about. So as one question with the point from Jiva Goswami, he said the human form has the ability to contemplate the soul. It gives the ability for the soul to contemplate its spiritual nature. Is that right? Yeah. And what was the other one?
And the other one was being able to contemplate the material creation.
Contemplate the material creation. Okay. I'm wondering about this concept of contemplation because sometimes I feel like I get so busy in devotional service and almost also kind of almost this misunderstanding that like any free time I possibly have I should be chanting and not thinking about anything, kind of like instead of like using the mind you should just always just smash the mind with the Maha Mantra, something like that. It's like a misconception. I mean, I think sometimes it's needed when the mind is, you know, contemplating things that aren't necessary, but I'm wondering about this positive contemplation and how to practically implement this concept of contemplation.
Thank you. It's a very exceptional question, and a practical question. Well, your strategy for dealing with the mind is a very practical strategy, and it's a means for reining in the unbridled nature of the mind. Because the minute one actually is chanting the Maha Mantra, then the mind is rearing its head, and one is pushing it aside and pushing it aside. So one's engaging in a battle. So it's actually an act of bravery to choose to deal with the mind that way on downtime. Another way of dealing with the mind is to provide it with a subject matter that is something that's attractive to it. So generally we see people spending an inordinate amount of time to try and meet the demands of the mind. By having already started the training process for the mind as you're doing, you're actually opening up space that you've pushed aside the clutter that's there. So in that space, you need to fill it. And the filling of it is the hearing of the activities of Lord Krishna. Said, like reading a page or two of Krishna book, you then actually giving material that's new material for the mind. And then that's where the contemplation factor comes in. One actually needs to quietly, it may even happen when one is performing some service or some activity during the day, but there'll be a moment where one can actually pause and actually recall what one has read. And when one recalls what one has read, one tries to process it. So this, you know, need not be a long period of time. It can be in a couple of minutes, but as one's processing, what one will find happening, because the intelligence starts operating, the minute you know you are taking spiritual subject matter, intelligence starts operating, and then one will start making connections with perhaps previous things one's heard, or even with something that one's grappling with in one's life. So this is that process of reflection. You filling the space in the mind that's being created by the good fortune of chanting the Maha Mantra. And that very precious material that you then put in there is what one can reflect on. So that precious material, I say Krishna books is a very easy one, because, and it's the recommendation of Srila Jiva Goswami, that it's the necessity to become completely convinced about the activities of the Supreme Lord. So what better way than to read a page or two of Krishna book and then reflect on it? So, I remember I received this advice many years ago. A devotee had mentioned to me, I said, you know, I like to be quite busy. And then the devotee said to me, it was an older devotee and I was very young. The devotee said to me, oh no, it's absolutely essential that you make time for some reflection. And now in doing this class, I'm understanding indeed it's essential. Absolutely essential. It gives nourishment and it strengthens conviction. So, you know, you're doing the controlling, but then you need to do the feeding too, the nourishing.
Thank you, Mataji, for the wonderful class. Prabhuji just asked about introspection. So I had a question about that. Like when we introspect, our intelligence and our senses are said to be imperfect. So how do we, in the process of introspection, how do we realize which direction to take in introspection? Because, like I said, it is said that that our intelligence and our senses are imperfect, and so
so the question is that how does one know what to which direction to take in introspection, taking into account that the intelligence or the senses may be imperfect? So Well, one is a slave, actually, to one's senses. So, actually, one has no control over one's senses unless one has taken to... chanting the names of Lord Krishna. And so the reason one is a slave to one's senses is not because the senses, because of the imperfection of the senses, but because one doesn't have the shelter of the master of the senses, who will then help one to control their senses. So there has to be the taking of shelter of the master of the senses, in order to be able to control those senses. So, if indeed one is able to chant the names of Lord Krishna through the Maha Mantra very attentively and very respectfully and with a genuine mood of taking shelter, then Lord Krishna himself gives assistance in terms of bringing the senses under control. So it's only then that one can actually speak of, which was the response to Giri Dari's question, of there being some genuine space in which one can contemplate. Actually, without that, taking to that process, there's no possibility of contemplation. One is merely a slave to one's senses. And what one is looking at in that particular case is merely the jumbled workings of one's mind with all the unfortunate activities that one's done for one's own pleasure that are, you know, bringing reaction. That's all one is looking at. There's no, one can't talk of contemplation in the proper sense of the word. So
that's the response. Thank you so much for the answer.
Well, thank you very much for your kind attention. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.